You are about to enter the pop, pulp, and subcultural minds of several individuals. What may leak into the ether can sometimes be too strange, too confusing for the average human mind. When nerds assemble.
Hello, and welcome to episode 47 of the Nerds Assemble podcast. I'm Emily.
I'm Paul.
I'm Paul, aka Retroid.
Sadly, we've got no Cookie with us this week, but this week we are joined by Chris Davidson, also known as DJ Cutman, a connoisseur and creator of chiptune-style music. He also runs the This Week in Chiptune podcast. Hi, Chris.
Hey, how's it going?
Chris is, I'm trying to think now, is he our first transatlantic?
I think so.
Yeah. Oh, my Ooh. Goodness, you're our first American on the podcast.
That's awesome.
Privileged, I think.
I feel very American.
We've caught one.
We've caught one, finally. According to our listener figures, most of the people that actually check out the podcast are from the US, which I always find a bit strange.
It must have really come.
Most of the people who listen to my podcast are from Chile, so that's also a little weird.
So there's...
Okay.
So yeah. There's a favorite... So people in Chile, like...
I think people just like foreigners. Everything kind of sounds better in an accent.
Yeah, I could see where we're going with that. okay, so we've got some news this week ranging from The Walking Dead to Lightning Returns to Nintendo. And then obviously we're going to be talking about Chris and the crazy, amazing musical stuff that he gets up to. First, our news. This bit, I would call it news. Basically, Channel 5 in their infinite wisdom of being run by, or being owned at least by, the guy that owns most of the porn channels in the UK, has decided that
he's a quality man.
He's a real quality man. They've decided to shunt The Walking Dead Season 3 from its 11 p.m. Saturday slot to 10 p.m. or 11 p.m. on Sundays. It was on Channel 5, it's now moved to 5 Star. And basically, they did this without... Well, they did this after the TV guide to the entire country had been published and shifted out to shops this week. They did it so last minute that Twitter, in certain sort of circles of it, was flooded with people going, "Where's Walking Dead?" Because come 11 on Saturday, obviously it wasn't on.
And what, just say, tell us, Emily, what did they replace it with?
More Big Brother.
That just says it all.
Can I just say, before we get into this, you said that he owns the porn channels in the UK.
Most of the porn channels.
It's not technically porn, it's just kind of softcore.
It's not actually, it's not quality.
Well, to be
porn.
Honest, you can't get away with really hardcore porn on UK channels anyway because of our obscenity laws. You know, legal.
It might confuse people.
But
it might break some stereotypes about the British, actually.
It is more or less the equivalent of any bit on Family Guy where they say about the English and porn. It's kind of like that, except with less class.
And more sort of bleach dyed blonde hair as well.
Oh yeah, yeah.
But yeah, so they decided to shift The Walking Dead in.
Not that I'd know.
Channel 5 shifts The Walking Dead. The reason they say they did this, and this tweet is not necessarily easy to come by, and it may not exist by the time you listen to this episode, but it's okay, we got a screenshot of it. They said, it was due to low ratings for the first episode the previous week.
Mm-hmm.
Which was kind of ridiculous. It was like, well, one, you put it on at 11 on a Saturday. It's a bit late for, you know, like a really popular show. Admittedly, in theory, better than them doing it on a Sunday like they'd previously done, because that's a school night, as it were. Then it was just kind of like, okay, so low rating, sure. Oh, but we're moving it to 5 Star. Not all of the country has 5 Star. But it's okay. It repeats the following day, so on the Monday, whilst we're recording this, it will be repeated quite late on Channel 5. Okay. Worse.
For a series of that caliber, it's insane.
Yeah, it's a school night. And then they were like, but it just, you know, hadn't had listener, well, not listener, sorry, viewer figures. And it's like, well, excuse me, but you put it on late. They didn't market it. Hardly anyone knew that The Walking Dead was back. That people had an inkling it had been coming back in the run-up to, you know, like, the other week, because it was like, they seem to be repeating the second season. Huh. That must mean that, you know, Series 3 is finally being aired on free channels in the UK. And then it happened, and it was like, well, there's, you know, hardly any advertising to tell us. And then, oh, and now we're shifting its slot against what had previously been publicized as its slot. Brilliant. So the view figures that they would have got, because there were lots of people complaining on Twitter on Saturday night, the view figures they would have gotten, they lost anyway, because all the people that wanted to watch it on Saturday were greeted by the other living dead members of Big Brother.
Probably with less going on.
Probably with less going on.
Although I would welcome some ripping of intestines and dismemberment.
It would probably liven up that series, I have to admit.
Yeah.
But I feel betrayed and annoyed.
Speaking of which, time to mention again Dead Set by Charlie Brooker. Very good.
Yeah. But I think part of the problem is that there's this general... generally tends to be this kind of thing with kind of... Not just kind of broadcasters, as it were, but like in game video games and whatnot with publishers, how they kind of put out like an initial thing and then expect it to, you know, kind of get so successful. And when it doesn't, they just drop it like a, you know...
Is this something you're going to be bringing up when we talk about Nintendo later?
Yes, very possible.
Okay. but regardless, basically, Walking Dead's moved. If you aren't aware of this already, and you were confused, the UK listeners, as to where your Walking Dead was on Saturday, this is why.
Oh, by the way, this is season 3 of Walking Dead. We've had to wait this long to start Walking Dead.
Well, only because we don't want to buy into having Sky and thus access to FX. They had
FX has already shown it, and it's been and gone.
But the annoying thing is that because of the sort of Channel 5 having the rights to show it, it
Channel,
does...
Channel 5 being, again, for foreign listeners, it's the free-to-air, in theory, everyone can get it on digital terrestrial TV, just with an aerial and a set-top box.
In that theory. Kind of... But the problem with them airing it now is, of course, that it obviously pushes back the time that they can release even the DVD or Blu-ray box sets, or put it on demand in any way or form.
Can you guys get it on iTunes or anything? See, because that's how I watch it. I don't even have TV anymore because cable companies here are just shit. So I subscribe on iTunes and it's just like, boom, there it is. And that's the only way I watch anything now is if it comes out of the internet. I lost my faith in cable TV here in the States a long time ago.
Unfortunately, I think, how many different cable companies have you guys got? Or is it also variant by
state? We have like,
all the place, isn't it?
There's a bunch of them, but each place only has one. So there's no competition and you're just screwed. So you got one terrible company, but there's no alternative. So you just have to pay that terrible company.
We've sort of similar situation. We've only got one satellite company, which is Sky, which is partially owned by the Murdoch empire.
Oh, yeah.
Then we've got one proper cable company, which is Virgin, Virgin Media, and then we've got a whole bunch of pretenders who keep trying to give people TV through the internet, but considering that connections in the UK are pretty crap, it's like, well, you're not really advantageous to the people that perhaps would like this, because they can't get it anyway. So, yeah.
Oh, that's brutal.
It's brilliant.
And this season's really good, too.
I still remember how Hulu was unsuccessful in trying to come over here because they couldn't reach any agreements with current channel owners or current platform owners for sort of like coming over here, which is why we still don't have Hulu.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
You could watch ads while your ads load, though.
Oh, that sounds awesome.
Even Hulu Plus, the one that you pay for, you still have to watch pre- and post-roll commercials.
Well, I mean,
it's crazy.
Mind you, that's like watching or doing anything like Xbox
360
for Xbox Live. It's like, okay, I've got gold. Huh, I've been absolutely sort of like
swamped
with ads everywhere as soon as I'm signed in. Brilliant. But I'm going to move us on now to a piece of gaming news. It may not seem major, but it's just annoying. And that is that Final Fantasy XIII Lightning Returns is getting, obviously it's getting DLC, but what was interesting was a piece of DLC announced last week, which was that Lightning will get a Cloud kind of outfit and weapon pack. I believe this is either if you pre-order and or it's available once you've bought the game. And I was just kind of like, oh, Great. Mm. So you're going to, because this game's clearly not going to sell fabulously. The enthusiasm towards this bit of the whole series has been somewhat limited. And it's like, right, well, we're going to entice people in because basically you can dress up Lightning as Cloud, which in a way is just a weird stint of just kind of transvestism, which I didn't even think they would be capable of, but it's cool. You got women dressed up in guys' clothes. It's technically being transvestite. But
yeah, that way round is...
It's perfectly acceptable.
Yeah, we can go with that.
Wait, but you know what? It's still done for, because there was that one time where Cloud dressed up as a woman in Final Fantasy VII.
Oh, so it's a callback.
Fine. Yeah. I think that's been very generous to it.
You know what they should have done? Specifically for the Steam version of Final Fantasy VII?
What?
Is had you so that you could actually, you know, that mini bit?
Yeah.
Where you could actually dress up as Lightning's outfit. That would have been quite funny.
So a weird polygon version of...
Yeah, that kind of would have been a little bit...
That might have been fair, I suppose. You know,
I'm really having to fight the urge to quote Queen here.
Oh, go on. Go
yeah,
on.
You should do it.
Lightning, very, very frightening.
There you go.
Oh, but
that's out there.
But it's just, it's clearly a move to obviously try and shift more copies of the game with this just superficial piece of DLC, and it's just like, yeah. I liked Final Fantasy VII. I absolutely hated 13 and 13 too.
I didn't make it past 12.
I didn't make it past 12 because the way they'd done the encounters, I found really... I liked my random encounters, basically. But then I still couldn't quite deal with... But then fighting on the map, I also found really weird. And then 13, obviously, you were still kind of seeing enemies in front of you, but you got brought into a separate battle scenario. I almost coped with that, but then the entire battle system and leveling up system messed me around far too much for my liking.
Can I just say, like, with alternate costumes in download content, yeah. I find it kind of weird how, in a way, expensive they are. I mean, if you kind of look on smartphones and whatnot, you can actually get full-blown apps for some of the prices that you get for costumes for... You know, this one character in a game.
Are you still bitter at looking at the DLC costs for Injustice Gods Among Us the other week?
Yes, I am. I am quite bitter. I mean,
by EA?
No, I was kind of tallying them up, and it's like you can only actually stick in like a certain amount into your basket at any one point.
Yeah.
So I think I got about halfway to kind of three quarters of the way, and it's already added up to almost £20.
But this was a combination of characters rather than
alternate admittedly
costumes.
It was a combination of characters and alternate costumes, but it's like, if you want everything, then
you're basically paying for the game again.
Exactly.
To get it all. Mm.
But I think we've still got a fair way to go before, is it Idolmaster, that Japanese 360 game?
It could be. It sounds vaguely familiar. And
where you have to sort of manage a female J-pop combo. I remember looking at the DLC for that years ago on the Japanese marketplace. Mm. And my God, it would cost an absolute fortune to buy all the outfits and variants.
You know what? I've just thought there is one game where there's like tons of DLC and it would cost a fortune to get all of it. Certainly Forza 3 and 4. The amount of DLC those two games had, you'd bankrupt you. I swear.
Wait for the Game of the Year version.
Yeah. I mean, to be honest, it wouldn't have been so bad if they would have actually had the season pass available on the Wii U version.
Of Injustice?
Yes. Mm. I mean, it still would have been fairly expensive, but it wouldn't have been as expensive.
But going back to Lightning Returns, it just feels like a really shallow move by Square Enix to make sales. So there will still be people suckered into getting it, but I'm just like, that's not happening.
I mean, I can't see how that game can be made, you know, because... judging from one of the, kind of things that have recently come out that we're probably going to be discussing more later on, stuff like Zombie U has sold so little that it won't be getting a sequel. How on earth did Final Fantasy 13 sell so much that could get two sequels?
Yeah.
They actually sold some consoles as well.
Mm. The
I apologize. I apologize for the. I just.
The thing about 13 though is basically the crowd apparently that's picked it up are probably all about 10 years or more younger than us.
Younger than you mean?
Yeah, younger than me. A lot more younger than yourself. And basically, they liked 13, apparently, these crazy people who had not played any of the early games. I'm not saying I liked the lack of graphics necessarily in the earlier games, but they had game systems that you could work with, and it wasn't a case of like constant blooming quick time events versus very simple button pressing during battles.
So, yeah. I've still not played 13.
Don't.
That's your review.
Go and grind through Lost Odyssey or Resonance of Fate. Do not go to 13.
I'm going to actually have a bash up to completing Grandi on my PSP. That's probably going to be a more worthwhile exercise, isn't it?
It would be.
But yeah, we're more kind of wanting turn-based RPGs back.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't necessarily... Yeah, you know, I can live without the random encounters. It's fine having the enemies on the map if you must.
Yeah, there's room for both.
There's room for it. I just want my turn-based.
You don't have to pick and choose. There can be variants. Go on.
But I want my turn-based back, man. I need my turn-based back. I mean, the closest I'm going to get to it this year is probably, I don't know, like, playing either Pokemon X or Y. That's probably the closest this year to a new game. I'm currently replaying Final Fantasy IX, but yes, the closest I'm going to get.
That's a bit wrong.
Yeah. Anyway, I'm going to move on to the next story. In episode 3 of this podcast, we talked about how the Dandy had pretty much gone tits up. The physical edition had its last issue published back in December last year, and earlier this year was kind of reborn on the internet.
Dandy Reborn
as a digital edition on a website that apparently had lots of technical problems, which led to a relaunch between it came back in sort of January, February, and it's relaunched after having technical problems in the last month or so now it's been shuttered again. Yeah.
Speaking of relaunches, Final Fantasy 14.
Sorry.
It was funny because the guy that kind of announced this, the break this, which is Wilbur, I can't remember his second name, but he draws a lot of comics for both children.
Or Dorban. Dorban?
Wilbur Dorban. I sort of announced it on Twitter, and then everyone just kind of piled on it last week. I've talked to the guy before online. He's pretty nice. He was like, "Oh, the editors told me it was shutting down," because he'd been drawing. I can't remember which series. Like, he'd been doing the odd sort of like strip for it, and it was just like, "Oh, okay, it's shutting down." And then DC Thompson rolled out a spokeswoman. On a trolley, and she said the Digital Dandy team has worked hard to produce an interactive and engaging app. While the digital comic has delivered its promised mixture of daft, dramatic, and different stories, the technology and format have let us down. For this reason, we're suspending the existing app and discussions and planning already underway to re-examine the Dandy's digital offerings. It is still too early to announce what form this next stage will take, but we would like to reassure readers that the Dandy remains a very important part of the company's plans for the future.
Wait. She said the technology and format have let them down.
Well, if you went and had a look at the website, which is still up, and now says under construction...
Surely that's them not being able to utilise the technology or the format.
Yeah, but remember, no one's been able to make any use of the internet to make money at all.
It's stupid, because they went and launched this. Meanwhile, before they launched this, the likes of the Phoenix comic, which fits in with the same market segment, kids... under the age of 15, have been doing pretty reasonably okay. They've had a physical edition, which is still going, but in the past 2-3 months, they also launched an iPad version. I'm not sure if you can read stuff directly from their website, but either way, they've gone digital partially, and they're still going. And it's like, this is what your upcoming competitors have managed to do. Meanwhile, you've suffered trying to do some kind of crap. I can't even tell if it was Flash or HTML5.
It was Flash.
Is it Flash?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know, because I went to the site to check it out, and it just wouldn't stop farting at me. And I tried to close the window, and it just kept farting and like actually like fart sound effects. And that's Flash looping. I used to do a lot of Flash, but my website's in Flash, and I know that there's a lot of things that if you don't take care of them, they can like totally wreck the user experience, or just like keep sounds going long after you've left the website, and that's what happened. Mm. I had to quit my browser.
But it's just ridiculous, because it's just kind of like, well, you guys obviously didn't throw enough money at it properly.
Yeah, it just sounds like they've desperately wanted to do it on the cheap, and that's blowing it back in their face.
Another thing is, I suspect
kind of like a fart noise.
I suspect they probably didn't get the eyeball figures that they wanted, as it were, because obviously it was a complete shift in format, and you know, without any real advertising to get people towards it. Meanwhile, I don't want to talk about the quality of the writing, but we did do a thorough examination in episode 3 of the Beano versus the Dandy, and did find the Dandy to be somewhat lacking in comparison to the Beano. It's competitor, though also owned by DC Thompson, and still has a physical edition. So, yeah.
You know that meme where it's like, you know, one guy having the head of these two kind of people and going, now kiss. It looks a bit like that to me. So DC Thompson is just kind of Dandy, Beano, kiss.
What, is it having them in the same company?
Yeah.
I mean, it's because they do actually share the odd few strips as well. Like, I think Numbskulls. Is that a Beano one that's ended up in the Dandy, I think?
I have no idea.
At least that's what I'd heard. I mean, I've never read it regularly enough to pay attention to these things. But, yeah, so DC Thompson have failed so far to make the Dandy's rebirth actually pay. I'm going to go and talk about Summer Kells now, because, quite frankly...
I was going to say, please, God, do.
This is the podcast of fail at the moment.
Okay, so. Okay, here's something.
And it will continue.
It will continue. Except for when we talk to Chris about his stuff, because there's no fail there.
Obviously, excluding that.
Okay, so this, we don't know yet if it's going to be a fail. It's perhaps something that's now become less of a fail, potentially. The Crow is currently being remade. Filming's meant to actually start in early 2014. It's a thing.
Mm.
Okay. if for those of you who somehow can't remember The Crow, it was originally a graphic novel, then got turned into a film starring Brandon Lee, the son of Bruce Lee, who then, sadly, this is Brandon Lee, died on set due to a misconfigured firearm that was meant to be a stunt weapon, apparently. But yes, yeah, so The Crow's creator, James O'Barr, is on board as a consultant to Relativity Media, who are currently remaking the film. I'm trying to say the adaptation of this is being written by Cliff Dorfman, and it's going to be starring Luke Evans as can't remember his name. The guy who is the Crow. Yeah, in the film. He's going to be the main guy. What's weird, though, is that... because I was looking Luke Evans up on IMDb. It's kind of weird. He's not got much of a filmography behind him. Probably partially due to his age. But he was in... He sort of, like, came from relative obscurity in a bunch of short films. And then suddenly started getting roles. One of which included... a character in the Three Musketeers movie that was at Disney, made in 3D and all that. He was like in that, and that he was a character called Shaw in Fast and Furious 6. I found it. I haven't seen Fast and Furious 6 yet, so I was like, oh, okay. So this guy's suddenly gone from having like short film roles suddenly to slightly major roles, which is quite strange. But it also means that a Welshman is going to be playing the role of the Crow in the remake.
I'm not going to make any Welsh jokes.
Don't make any Welsh jokes. We might have Welsh listeners that we don't know about.
I can say I have Welsh blood very close in my my family line, so you know, I can. That's the rule.
Oh, okay. I thought you meant as like on a in a jar.
On a shelf.
I also have Welsh blood right here. But, yeah.
F. Javier Gutierrez is meant to be directing the adaptation. I can't remember what he's worked on. It's not much, actually, but the last big thing he worked on was from, like, 2008, as far as I can tell.
To be honest, sometimes it can actually work in their favour if they actually have people that are fairly unknown.
unlike the case of World War Z and its director. Not that I'm bitter about the direction a lot of that film took. Not that I'm bitter.
In your opinion, World War Z can go die.
Again and again. It scared me.
I liked it.
It scared me a lot. I liked it.
I liked it too.
I liked the fact that it scared me. I didn't like the fact that they didn't stick to the style of the novel.
Oh.
Oh, but how would that have even worked? It's like so fresh.
I would have loved a, what's the term? It's a mini...
serialization?
It's not a mini serialization, when you have like all the multiple narratives.
That would have been really cool.
Yeah, sort of like, almost like, is it Magnolia or something like that? Like all the different narratives kind of as the film and just kind of building up basically into one whole thing. But anyway, Luke Evans is the Crow. It's going to start filming next year. Apparently, early next year, in fact. Unless, of course, we hear otherwise.
For a second, I thought you were turning into William Shatner or something.
Really? Because I hope that never
happens.
It's going
to be filming early next year.
And now I will take revenge on the evildoers. It's another one where, well, just make it into a TV series. Do an HBO or a Showtime or whoever.
There is a Crow TV series.
A proper one.
I can't say whether or not it's a proper one because
I've seen clips.
Can't get a proper import of it into the UK because it only had an English release in the US. Any imports? Apparently, there's a Dutch version. A Dutch version that would obviously be region 2 that we could import, but it would all be in Dutch. There would be no English subtitles.
It was shown on UK TV, on one of I think something like CBS. Action or something. As in it, one of the it's such a small channel, it's even just restricted to such and such a number on Sky.
Is it one of those small channels that only actually work during certain parts of the day?
I think it might be.
That would make sense. I'm gonna move us on to it's probably just more disappointment. But maybe not at the same time. Maybe it's something.
Nintendo, come on.
Maybe we can get excited about this. Nintendo are working on super secret games.
They're working on games.
They're working on games. They're working on non-traditional games, which for them means they're working on games that don't just include Mario.
Their traditional, isn't it?
Yeah.
Non-traditional games are traditional.
So they're working on non-traditional super secret games. They're keeping it quite hush-hush as to what these games might be. This is even in the call with investors that they had last week, the usual kind of financial announcements and stuff. Neil Walter was like, yeah, we're not telling you what this stuff is.
So just tell us, you are actually working on things, aren't you?
Yeah, that was close as they got. It was we're working on stuff.
The thing is,
they're just all sitting around playing Animal Crossing in their headquarters.
That's true. They probably are.
The thing is,
there's a lamp. I've got to get that.
Is that they've turned around and said that they're brand new types of games, which is the more interesting part. As if like they're going to be almost like new genres.
Games that will sell enough.
Games that will do interesting things with the Wii U gamepad.
Yeah.
I'm so unconvinced about the Wii U gamepad. I just
Oh well, I love my Wii U, but I'm a Nintendo fanboy. But the other day, I was watching The Next Generation on the Wii U, and I got really hungry, and I had to make myself some food. So I took my gamepad, and I was playing on my TV, and I took my gamepad into the kitchen. And hit a button, and the Next Generation episode didn't even stop. It just went over to the controller, and I just like potted up on my stove and like cooked myself a meal. Went back over to the TV, hit a button, it was back on the TV, and I just felt like I was the future right there. I realized what Nintendo was getting at. It seems super gimmicky at first, but I don't know. Not having to stop my entertainment and go into another room, and it's like there, and not being like, hold on, let me get my iPad and sync it. Oh, damn it, I have to reboot. You know, it's just like, boom, boom, boom. It just worked. And I don't know, it felt really good. Nintendo had my heart at that moment.
Two things there, right? Uh-huh. One, you were watching Star Trek Next Generation, which is ace, but you were doing that instead of playing a game.
Ah. But I think I was also game faxing how the hell to get out of the Goron village in Oracle of Ages, because I've been stuck there for like weeks, downloaded that on my 3DS. And it was so fun. And then I realized it's Capcom doing a Zelda game. And Capcom does a lot of things right. But one thing that Nintendo gets and Capcom doesn't is puzzles. Nintendo knows how to make a puzzle that makes you think and then you get it.
Yeah.
Capcom knows how to make a puzzle that is either clearly obvious from the start or nightmarishly hidden. Yeah.
I could totally get that with the Capcom puzzle situation, because I've played two Ace Attorney games and I've played most of the Resident Evil games.
Yeah.
Puzzles are resilient. Yeah, okay. The early ones is a bit hit and miss. Some of the later ones, they're so easy, you always get. Especially that door in Resident Evil 4. The door in the house where you kind of turn this orb and it's got like the Luminato's symbol, whatever it is, that you kind of bring up. Have to turn it twice. Mm. And there's almost no way you can turn it wrong. And it opens, but then versus like the whole of the second Ace Attorney game and just almost nothing being logical at all in terms of the lines of questioning and trying to get through cases in court. It's just absolutely insane. So yeah. I can totally see how Nintendo, yes, they get puzzles when I've seen other people play through lots of Zelda versus Capcom.
But, I mean, one of the quotes that I've heard of recently is, I think it might have been from Miyamoto, that has turned around and said basically that new types of games come in from kind of new gameplay and stuff like that, rather than new characters. You know, everybody kind of complains about the fact that, oh, we've got another Mario game. Mm. But if you kind of look at the progression of Mario to see, you know, what kind of mechanics have come in and, you know, what's been, you know, added to the series, it's like, if you kind of just took the two extremes, you know, say for example Mario Galaxy and the original Mario Bros. Those are completely different. They are both platformers, but their mechanics are so, you know, dissimilar that I think people sometimes just kind of look at it and go, oh, it's another Mario game, rather than it's an awesome game in its own right.
Meanwhile, I believe more people need to play the Paper Mario games.
Those are awesome as well.
You know, I haven't played the Paper Marios.
You should. Their acerbic wit and humor is amazing.
Oh yeah.
It's a beauty to behold. When they said sort of like, we're not going to be making games that are traditional to us, and I was like, that could be good in terms of the mechanics. And I was like thinking,
Call of Duty Mario.
That would be horrific.
It wouldn't be traditional to them.
I would like to think that maybe they own the rights to say something like the Star Fox game. The Crystal Adventures game that never was, that got turned into Star Fox Adventures. I'd like to think that somebody would resurrect that and turn it into not necessarily a platformer, but almost like a Beyond Good and Evil. Because the mechanics for Star Fox Adventures are actually quite similar to a lot of Beyond Good and Evil's mechanics. Though minus, obviously it was two different companies.
I was just thinking there, Nintendo Wii, what would make me buy one? Well, first of all, games and it being cheaper.
Well,
but
you've previously turned around and said Pikmin 3.
Yeah, Pikmin 3 is definitely one which is, as soon as it's out in the shops, it's like, I want that.
Well, it's going to be out later this month.
But first of all, two things. Right, Nintendo, I know you listen to this. No, you don't. buy the rights and do Panzer Dragoon.
Ooh.
On the Wii U. You can we can have an RPG and you can reskin the Panzer Dragoon games and a sequel to Orta.
You know, I have the Sonic Racing game for the Wii U, which is shockingly good.
I just bought that on Steam because it was on sale. And the thing that brought that to mind was it's got a Panzer Dragoon track.
Exactly, yes.
And you're like, I want this.
Mm-hmm.
I want more Panzer Dragoon, go on. And also, if you could do Rez on the 3DS, there you go.
Oh, that's a great idea, too. You should send these in and they'll send your letter back. Thank you for sending your letter, but we don't read letters that are sent to us.
Yeah, we do.
Your friends at Nintendo. Here's 200 Club Nintendo points. I'd send a letter every day if they gave me points for that.
I think one thing Nintendo needs to work on is that obviously releases for the Wii rather than the Wii U are obviously slowly pretty much drying up. And it's like, well, what's going to be the family kind of console if you've got kids under the age of, like, I don't know, 13 or 12? Because, quite frankly, the way they're going with, like, the PS4 and the Xbox One, it's like parents will be thinking, this seems a little bit too adult for Jimmy, darling. I think we should buy something that's more kid-friendly. And it's like, I know Nintendo kind of, with the Wii, the balance between family and core audiences kind of got a bit too messed up. But from a financial perspective, maybe they do need to kind of, you know, just bring in the family audience just a bit more again.
To be honest, I mean, people have been disappointed in sales in the Wii U, but I mean, if you kind of look at a lot of the stuff that's meant to be kind of coming out for the PS4 and for the Xbox One, some of those games, they're going to be on the PS3 and Xbox 360 as well, so it's going to struggle to actually sell, you know, the next generation consoles. Yeah.
Mm.
So, in my opinion, the Wii U is actually in a fairly decent position.
I think so as well.
Realize it.
I respectfully disagree.
I was going to say, just go back to my mention of Crystal Adventures, as in Crystal from Star Fox, get her own game, and then also mentioning...
As it
should have been to start off, like, make that a thing. But also, what was it? Same Beyond Good and Evil. What the heck's happened about Beyond Good and Evil 2? There was, like, that weird sort of teaser, like, over a year ago, like probably 2 years or more now.
It's about 2 or 3 years now.
Yeah, her thingy, and then there was just like, oh, there's been nothing since. And it's like, I'm assuming that's probably died a death.
Probably. I'd say it's either died a death or it's been bumped up to next gen.
But then, like, if we're talking about, well, who's going to be buying... Like, I know a lot of a lot of older gamers really liked Beyond Good and Evil, but it was quite popular with younger audiences as well. And if you've got people of the younger persuasion, as it were, young people not being given...
I believe you mean whippersnappers,
dagnabbers. Because they're not going to be able to probably afford an Xbox One or a PS4 without some parental financial help, and the parents be like, oh, it's not a kid-friendly looking console, we're not going to get that for you.
But that Microsoft are going to sell 400 million X-Bones.
But what I'm trying to say is, like, well, then if one were making Beyond Good and Evil 2, what would one put it on now?
There again, I mean, you say about, you know, kind of the delay in Beyond Good and Evil.
Yeah.
But that happens a lot with games industry.
Which is the sequel, the other sequel that's been going on for ages that's to do Sony and PlayStation. I can't remember. Is it a sequel to Shadows of the Colossus, or am I imagining?
Oh, yeah, Trico. As it's called.
But I mean, look how long Duke Nukem took.
I know people who bought PS3s for Trico.
Okay. And it never
happened. Can imagine how they feel.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, Final Fantasy 13 Versus has now been, you know, elevated to
the final 15.
And yeah, it's...
I mean, do you know what's annoying? I said it the other week, was it, when we did the E3 episode, but Final Fantasy 15, it's like, I like the look of the story, but damn, there's nothing resembling turn-based in there. You bastards. You know, I can't go near it. Anyway, so Nintendo...
It's okay, they'll include a pack of cards with it, and then you can play that while you're mashing buttons.
I was just thinking, what... Other than messing around with, like, the Wii gamepad, what would Nintendo count as non-traditional games for them? So it's surely that they're not saying, oh, we're going to put out our own Call of Duty. That's insane.
Well, no, but, I mean, they've
maybe like smaller games? I don't know.
You know, stuff like Wii Fit, you know, WarioWare and stuff like that, they've been at the forefront of kind of creating new content.
Augmented reality stuff. I see Nintendo, they gave those little weird cards that you can put with the 3DS and see a 3D thing run around. But One of the things in Nintendo Land, which I got with my console, I played a little bit, and then I got Sonic, and my life just died at that moment. and all I do is play Sonic All-Stars. That game is so hard, but so good. Anyway, the augmented reality thing, if you took the Wii U gamepad in some of the games and you stood in the middle of your living room, some of the mechanics, you can use the joysticks to turn your character around. But if you didn't touch the joysticks and you just stood in the middle of the living room, you can hold your controller around, like, in front of your face and turn, like, physically turn in circles, and it'll show you the whole environment, like, properly. So if you hold up the gamepad to the ceiling, you see the sky and the world you're in. You hold it up.
That kind of thing is cool. And that's why I want Metroid Prime in it, damn it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I feel like Nintendo God. Land was them seeing what properties, like, make sense in that kind of format. Because then it's not even like, I get simulator sickness, they call it. That's the military word. More of it is it's the most tragic part of my life is that I can't play a 3D game like a new Zelda or Portal or Halo for more than 20 minutes. Or I get, like, terrible...
That probably sounded sarcastic, but that was a heartfelt all.
It's a tragic, tragic thing, because video games are like my life, and when I beat the new Zelda game, Skyward Sword, it took me an entire year, because I had to play, like, 10 minutes on, 10 minutes off, 10 minutes on, 10 minutes off. And thank God I have a great girlfriend who, like, would play while I, like, just sat and, you know, played something on my 3DS for those 10 minutes, or else I go back and I am, like, sick for the rest of the night. But that, you know, augmented reality with the gamepad, something about the way... it works with physically moving is I don't get sick that way. I guess maybe because the camera's moving with me physically moving the thing, it's more accurate. My brain
it
is like...
It makes more sense to your brain.
Yeah, it's like, oh, we can do this. Yeah, whereas, like, Halo, it's like, spin around and everything's too clear. Time to barf.
I liked using the sort of moving around with the gamepad and stuff like Zombie U and Batman Arkham City on the Wii U. It's kind of nice just when you're doing scanning and stuff.
I mean, technically speaking, because there's a near field communicator built into the Wii U gamepad, if I'm not mistaken.
Is it NFC or is it infrared?
I thought it was. Well, I think it's got both. So okay. It can obviously change channels on the TV. And I've heard that it's got a NFC on the pad itself. So I think it'd actually be quite cool is to have it so that, you know, you can actually set up, like, say, for example, four posts with NFC kind of tags on each one of them. And you can actually navigate kind of a world using that.
Ooh.
I reckon that'd be quite cool.
You should probably...
be really cool.
Ooh, could you imagine a horror game like that?
That was better than Zombie U.
Yep.
I'm still stuck thinking about wandering around in Metroid Prime.
It would look beautiful.
With visors.
Yes, absolutely.
It would look so beautiful. You know what? All this augmented realities remind me of the fact that Story came out today. I say Story... what was her name? The lady that was heading up a bunch of Valve's hardware stuff that got fired earlier this year.
Jerry Ellsworth.
That's the lady.
Who I have a professional geek crush on. and I say professional because I will point out that before she did all this, she's heavily into Commodore 64 hardware. And she's programmed hardware clones and the C64 DTV, which was a plug-in joystick. And which came with about 20 Commodore 64 games. That was not only designed by her, but it is actually an upgraded Commodore 64 hardware compatible PCB that you can add disk drives and keyboards to. The points are on the board. That's how much of a geek she is, and that's why I have a geek crush on her. Anyway, right, carry on.
Well, obviously today... it was publicised the fact that podcast with her has come out and basically her talking about how she got fired from Valve and everything. But what I hadn't realised at the time when she was originally fired back in February was that she'd actually been working on sort of like in the evenings at Valve, like, you know, it's her own little pet project type thing. It was a whole bunch of augmented reality stuff. And that's basically what she's working on now. Valve basically, it was like part of the agreement of her leaving, was that she basically got to take this AR stuff with her and continue working on it.
And I'm not biased at all, but I'm sure it was better than Oculus Rift.
Not biased at all. Maybe a little bit. But
quite biased.
But it does make me wonder, like, with, because the hype on AR has kind of died down a bit. I mean, like, sort of the interest in, because Skylanders was a minute attempt at it. I've played two games that use AR that were aimed at kids, like properly using AR. Yeah, for review purposes, and that was the second Invisimals game. Oh dear lord! And
it's an interesting idea. It's just it. I think it's like touchscreens to start off with. It's waiting for the right implementation with the right reasons.
The other was the it was an iPad game, but it was for the PSP. And that was just weird, but it didn't use the AR anywhere as much as Invisibles did. But anyway, like, it's been kids' games so far that have kind of properly gone in for AR.
I think that's part of the mistake.
I think there's cool stuff that could be done for those over the age of, you know, 9. That involves augmented reality. But anyway, that's a conversation for another day.
It's kind of weird, because, I mean, say, for example, with a release, not necessarily release, but when the 3DS first kind of was kind of announced and whatnot, there's a lot of these technologies and whatnot that you can't actually kind of get to grips with until you actually get the product there in your hand. And I think that could be where, you know, a lot of stuff falls down. Say, for example, stuff like Kinect or motion controlling, before, like, the Wii kind of came along and whatnot. And everybody was so like, well, I've got my controller. I like my controller. Why don't you just leave the controller as it is? And, you know, you can't actually kind of get a sense of how things will work just from, like, watching a video.
I agree with that. Meanwhile, the public's ability to adapt to certain types of new technology is somewhat limited. It's like, what was it, like the reason Apple aren't putting NFC at the next iPhone is because members of the public are hardly using it. So there's like, not going to be any NFC.
It's a catch-22 though, because, you know, without NFC-enabled devices, people aren't going to use it.
And without
because
NFC,
they don't know how to use
yeah,
it.
People need it.
Because it's not in the market.
Meanwhile, there's been like banks stuff, obviously trying to roll it out for certain things, and obviously sort of transport and stuff. But it's like, yeah, apparently I could do crazy things with NFC with my phone if I could be bothered to buy stuff to do it with and then configure it.
I'm not entirely sure about the configuring, but from what I've read up, what you can actually do is, say for example, you stick one on your door.
What, these tag things?
Yeah, these tag things. Stick one on your door so that when you actually come in through the door, it'll automatically take you off the mobile network.
The 3G.
3G networks, yeah. And actually go onto your Wi-Fi instead automatically.
My phone does that automatically.
Does it?
Yeah.
Well, as soon as you step through the front door.
Mine doesn't. I think it's the fact that it's not only the switch over, it's the fact that it turns off, like physically turns off 3G on the phone so that you haven't got it turned on. Because obviously it's the case of it will obviously, almost all current smartphones will just automatically switch over when it meets the network it's configured for. The handover happens instantly. But it's the fact that the NFC would turn off the 3G receiver.
Well, I just know on mine that when I look at the power consumption reports, the 3G antenna is much lower when I'm at home than when I'm out and about.
Yeah, obviously that's just kind of one case of it. Say, for example, if stores actually had NFC kind of stuff in things, then...
What, payment points?
No, not payment points. But say, for example, if you went into a store... Right, so say for example something like Sainsbury's and there's NFC on there, then I'm wondering whether they could actually configure it so that as soon as somebody walks in through with a smartphone, they get the option to download an app or kind of a map of the store or kind of a price list of
vouchers or something.
I'm sure there's sorts of crazy things that we don't
exactly
see.
Exactly, they're just not being utilised
because no one can be asked. And that's both from a business perspective and the users.
I'm gonna bring us back away from this tangent.
That's fair enough.
And go. It's time to move on and talk about all the awesome stuff.
Absolutely.
That Chris is up to, because if you like chiptunes or games music, of pretty much any kind, Chris seems to be heavily involved in all this amazingness. Amazingness is a new word. I'm keeping with that.
Would swamped be a correct term?
Yeah, I think so.
Amazingness, ossity.
Do you want to give just a brief rundown of just what you're currently involved with, I think that might be one of the easiest things we could do.
Yeah, let's see if I can get it together. There's so much going on. And this month in particular has been like crazy with projects. So I guess the biggest thing, or the oldest thing I've been doing, is I've been DJing video game music as DJ Cutman for the past bunch of years. I started as a coping mechanism for me to deal with a terrible job and a terrible living situation. And sort of became like my release, and I really started doing it just for myself. And I posted a set on SoundCloud page. And then one day I was walking down the street of my town, going back to my crappy apartment or to my crappy job. And somebody stopped me and they said, "Hey, I listen to that video game thing that you posted on the internet like every day." And this was a person that I knew, but it wasn't really like a friend. He was an acquaintance, and he just see me on the from the other side of the street and come over and stop and say, "Hey, I love the video game thing." That really like kind of was like, well, if I love it too, I kind of made it for myself anyway. So I just started doing it, remixing game music and then playing game music out in a public place wherever I could find. And as a DJ who had only been DJing for a month, no place in their right mind would book me, and I didn't know any crazy places. So what I did is I brought my speakers, I loaded my computer speakers into my cat carrier with my DJ board and a surge protector and extension cord, and I would just walk out with this cat carrier full of sound equipment and find a public outlet and just plug in and DJ out on the street. And I did that for months, just because I wanted to share chiptune music, I wanted to share video game music. And and then one day I got a gig at a waffle shop. I was, without realizing it, I was DJing outside of a waffle shop as they were closing, and somebody come out and be like, "Hey, do you want to come inside?" And I was like, "Thanks, I don't have any money for a waffle." And they're like, "No, you're like, you can play in here next Friday. It'd be cool, and we'll give you free waffles." And I'm like, "That sounds great. Let's do it." Fast forward a bunch of years, I'm still doing that, you know, not for waffles, but video game music and chiptunes. I run a label called Game Chops, and we produce high quality dance music based on old video game songs. And then we get what's called a mechanical license from the publisher or the copyright holder. So we can put them up on iTunes, put them up on Spotify, play them on the radio without having to worry about a takedown request or anything. So we're basically making cover songs of video game music. But me and a lot of my friends, we all love chiptunes so much that we're recreating it with sounds that sound similar to the original. So it's still a cover song, but it's got that feeling, that chiptune, that 8-bit feel. And I don't know, I just sort of love it. I just kind of, like I said, I started doing this stuff because I really loved it. And I've just been sticking to it. So now I talked about the label Game Chops. I run a blog, videogamedj.com, where I share chiptune and video game music. And I have a few of my friends who are also sharing stuff that they like on there. So if you need new music, or if I need new music, I just log on to my own blog and I'm like, "What did Will post today? Oh, that's awesome. I'm going to download that right now." And I'm just going on and on. Luckily, we have this little list here in front of me.
Okay, so, all right.
And what else? My gosh.
I think we'll ask you some questions and then you can talk a bit more about what you've got going on this week in particular.
Yeah.
Okay, so out of interest, because obviously the systems, the older game systems, the retro systems and that, because we're going to talk about chiptunes a little bit. Obviously they'd all have kind of like different ways that they process sounds or whatever with what was available for the coding and stuff. But which of the older game systems do you feel have perhaps some of the most compelling games music?
Well, you know, the Nintendo is awesome, the original Nintendo Entertainment System, which I have my original one from 1985 sitting right here on top of my computer. It's not super behave. It's not the best behaving piece of music hardware, but it just got a sound, like a really kind of beefy sound. The same with the Nintendo Game Boy, the original big brick DMG Game Boy. And I'm not sure what the engineers at Nintendo were doing, if it was like an accident or they had thought about this long term, or maybe it was just how the technology worked. But those systems, the original Nintendo and the original Game Boy, actually have really huge sounds if you plug them into an amplifier, mixing board, or something like that. They really sound huge and awesome by today's standards, which is crazy. If you plug a Super Nintendo for example, or a Sega Genesis. Genesis has got some cool stuff, but like a Super Nintendo, even like a modern system, closer to the modern system, PS1 or PS2 into a system. It doesn't have the same kind of oomph. It sounds like it's playing a recording. The Super Nintendo played like 16-bit samples, so it had like this kind of round quality. But the original Nintendo and the original Game Boy have this really like clear and thick sound. And
I think chip tunes are a very unique sound.
Yeah, definitely. They are. But and to add to that, I think that's what's made some chiptunes so popular is that the hardware that they're based off of or created with still sounds good. Like the Game Boys, you plug them into a mixing board, you plug them into a guitar amp, and if you have something interesting programmed on there, it'll come out sounding really fat and really huge, like could be on point with an electric guitar or a drum machine, a modern piece of equipment. And these things are, you know, 20 years old. When was this Game Boy made? 1993?
Wow.
And it still sounds like a big, awesome instrument. And
I think the original Game Boy came out around 88, 89, something like that.
What am I looking at? I'm looking at the Play It Loud, the red one right here. Because everything I have is red or black or red and black.
Okay.
that's my MO. But the Game Boy Colors came out in 93, and they all have like different sounds and different qualities. And I think what's cool about the chiptune movement in general is that people are really starting to learn what music sounds good on what pieces of hardware. Like an Atari has a really sweet, almost Skrillex-y kind of sound. So I know Ultracid from France has done some songs that just sound amazing. They sound like they're produced with a modern computer, like awesome dubstep, housey, dancey kind of music, and he plays them on an Atari. Like I saw him live here in Philadelphia just a couple months ago. And
Atari console or an Atari 8-bit?
An Atari console with the little sound expansion port that I guess nobody bought except for Ultracid. And right. Now he's really putting it into use because, you know, they all have these expansion ports. The Nintendo has one. The Nintendo 64. I'm pointing to the systems in my room right now. I realize it doesn't add much to the podcast.
There were some smashing trousers you're wearing, by the way.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, they were my father's. but I think with a lot of the chiptunes, the chiptune scene and the way that it's growing, there's so many sites and labels and stuff that do chiptune music that people are starting to really realize what hardware sounds good for what kind of music. Like dance music sounds amazing coming out of a Game Boy. Like so, so good out of like a single Game Boy or two Game Boys. You can make a really awesome dance or drum and bass track on a Game Boy and it sounds awesome.
Like
the Nintendo.
I was just going to I'll just jump in there. Yeah. The music for Super Hexagon. I think that was done on Game Boy.
Oh, yeah. That's Chipsol. Yeah, she's amazing.
Yeah,
and she does all of her stuff on a Game Boy too. I know there's a guy named Schnabubula, I think that's how you say it, who does this. Who has an amazing album that is a regular Nintendo console and acoustic piano, and those two instruments sound brilliant together.
I've heard that.
Yeah, it's great. What's it called? Oh, the DJ here not knowing the names of his own songs. I'm just proud that I got Schnabubula out of my mouth. That's a good thing. Oh, it's called Nest Jams. And it's Nintendo and piano, and it sounds amazing. And people are using Commodore 64s
My personal favorite, though.
Yeah, it's awesome. And it has awesome characteristics that, like, you can fake with a computer, you can emulate with another piece of gear. But if you have that real C64, a sample of it, a recording of it, or the actual machine, it has this quality, like an old synthesizer, that you can't fake, that you can't...
There's at least one synthesizer and a sound card, which they're both based on SID chips from the Commodore.
Yeah, and it's like those sounds. I don't know if it was the intention of the original designers of the hardware to make something that would really withstand the test of time. I mean, I feel like all good technology should strive for that. But in the case with these chiptunes, and maybe, you know, it's the way that people are writing music for it now and the software that's come out, it's really just amazing to me how something so simple as a single Game Boy from 1987 or a Nintendo console from 1985 is still, you know, it's close to being one of the cheapest instruments that you can buy these days. You want to start making music, go on eBay, get yourself a Game Boy for $40, order a cart from Kitchbent or something, and start making music for less than $100. You can't buy a piano for that, or a drum machine, or a piece of software for your computer. So I think it's also enabled a lot of people in lower income families or lower income countries to start making this really great music. And because of the nature of chiptunes, putting everything online, a ton of chiptunes are free. Almost everything's Creative Commons. So even if you do buy it, then you can use it in your show or your podcast or whatever.
Yeah, because people want listeners. They want people to hear it.
Exactly. And it's that is sort of pushing everybody else forward and creating new music and motivating these people to make something that sounds better than the last thing they put out, because so many people heard it, 1,000 people downloaded it, so the next thing's got to be better. And what can you do? You write with 2 Game Boys, write with a Nintendo and a piano, you know, use a drum machine and a Game Boy. That's what I've been experimenting with since I got my new
Beyond the ease of actually generating the music, as long as you know what you're doing, are there any other reasons why you think chiptunes continues to be popular as a musical niche?
Oh, yeah. I have a great answer for that. It's great because I'm going to enjoy saying it in 1 minute when I digress. And it's because it's the reason that I really love it, is that chiptunes doesn't sound like anything else. And there's so much electronic music out there. There's so much more than ever. 2 years ago, Skrillex came out and he had his EP and everyone was like, oh my God, it's techno. And 2 years later, it's not been a long time. Now that style is rampant. Dubstep is everywhere. People are getting in and having successful world touring careers, really young, age 16, 17, you know, dedicating, you know, all their time after high school to learning Massive or learning Ableton and being able to produce this music, which is so cool that it's easy to make music. But the problem is with the laptop musicians and the laptop music culture is that because there is no hardware, everything comes out with this kind of same wrapper. And you can have 1,000 genres, you can have 1,000 styles, you can have 1,000 samples. But when you listen to a song that was recorded on a dedicated piece of hardware, there are these characteristics, there are these flaws, there are these things that just make it inherently different. Even if it's the same song, note for note, on a Game Boy or on a laptop computer, they're going to sound different. And I think that over the past few years, we've been so flooded with laptop music that chiptunes, people making music that has restrictions, you know, with a Game Boy, you have 4 channels and that's it. You can't have 64 tracks of dubstep wobbles and then 128 tracks of drums. No, you have 4 and you got to write your whole song with 4 unless you get another Game Boy and then you only have 8. And I think that this kind of chiptune mentality, which is using the restrictions to make something more creative, I think really goes a long way in making chiptune a unique and a kind of permanently unique, if that makes any sense, kind of music. And that's why I love it so much. It just doesn't sound like anything else.
Oh my God, that was a brilliant answer. I'm sorry, I'm just...
Did you practice that one?
No, I didn't, but I've been thinking about it for a long time.
Okay, brilliant. I'm going to... that one that I did have written down. I'm going to move on into this one, which is a bit away from the chiptunes for a minute. But
no.
It's still about the retro. Don't worry. Okay. Why do you think people continue to be drawn towards retro games or their stylistic traits, such as shown by many indie titles?
Oh, I think there's a lot of reasons. I think that the old school games, particularly platformers and 2D games, relied more on the playing of the game than the presentation of the game. So when you play a new game, Call of Duty or whatever, they have a winning formula of a fun game, but each year a new one comes out with a different characters, or now you have a dog, or this, that, and the other thing. But the game is virtually, you know, the same. They're built onto this formula that a lot of people like. I don't play much Call of Duty, or first-person shooters because of the dizzy thing. But when you have a retro game, again, like the chiptune, you have your limitation. You don't have a free running world where you can go and do anything that you want. You know, there are some indie titles that make that. So strive for that in a retro style thing. But the core of whether a game is good or not is based on how you play it and the experience of playing it. Whereas a modern game like Call of Duty, it's like, how good is the game? Well, does it have the most realistic weaponry? Does it have the most awesome sound? Does it have the greatest graphics and that kind of stuff? Where if you're playing the original Mario Brothers, that game is hard as hell and super fun. And it fits on a, you know, it's a less than 1 megabyte of code to make that game. And the game's still fun. And that's because the core of the game, running and jumping, is fine-tuned and tweaked until it was like you could speed run those old games. You don't see people speed running Call of Duty, you know, or Halo. I mean, I'm sure there are people out there that are doing it, but the really awesome stuff to see is the people who are speed running Super Metroid. These old games that were, because they're simpler, by playing them for years and playing games that are styled like that, there's like almost, it almost seems like you need to have more skill to be good at an old school or a retro style game than, you know, some brand new 3D awesome fest.
It's a kind of a purity of the mechanic that has to be exact. And if it isn't, then it doesn't matter if you've got god rays and dust and look at the realistic fur on the dog.
Yeah, exactly.
You can't do any of those.
Yeah, exactly. It comes down to the game, the actual gameplay. And that's why, although it sucks that I get simulator sickness and I can't play a lot of 3D games, it doesn't totally shatter my heart because I have played a lot of those games and they just don't pull me in as much as a simple, like, solid gameplay experience. And I mean, that's what I I've always liked growing up. I've had games just about my whole life. And what is fun is something that I can sit down, start playing, and enjoy right off the bat. I don't like games that are super complicated, that I have to sit through half an hour of tutorials. I actually cannot survive half. I downloaded a game for my iPad, and I was like, oh, this is going to be so good. The reviews are so good. Real-time strategy, ultimate points, all these weapons. And it's like, 22 minutes into the tutorial video, I like just stopped. I was like, I need Zelda 2 right now. I need to jump and kill in the next 5 seconds. So for me, at least, I think the allure of the retro game is that it's simple, and in that simplicity, they can make a better game.
Because it's a lot simpler as well. I mean, playing like with platformers, each platformer feels different, you know, kind of the response time for when he jumps, or you know how high he jumps, how fast you can control his jump and whatnot, and it feels a lot more diverse in the controls than, say, for example, first person shooters today.
Yeah, and you know, you can do a lot with a little. Like going back to the Chim 2 mentality, if you have a simpler setup, you can allow the player to get more invested, learn the game, and really get and really have a unique experience different to each person. I know that, when my girlfriend sits down at Mario, she plays in a completely different way than I play and still has a great time, where I'm like running through the levels, she's like methodically getting everything. And in a game like, I don't know, Call of Duty, it's like you're either killing guys as fast as possible or you're getting killed too much, and that's how you play that game. But with a simple game, like even the new Mario for the Wii U, be a fan of the Wii U or not, the simple side-scrolling 2D kind of opens up more for, I guess, player creativity. How do you want to play that game? And I think that's where I have fun. I don't really like being dropped into a box and be like, all right, go. I want to kind of design the own way that I want to play. I want to try to get really long jumps. I want to try to do it really fast. I want to try to get everything. And retro style games, I think, just lend themselves better to that kind of gameplay. And, you know, I grew up with that kind of stuff, so I guess it's close to the chest.
Okay. Retroid, have you got anything that you really wanted to ask? Because I know what you're like with this kind of...
What am I like? Right. I think most things have been covered.
Okay.
Well, while you're kind of thinking of a question, can I just ask one?
Of course.
How do you actually go about the process of creating this music? I mean, is it obviously you've kind of talked about the hardware itself? Do you kind of take samples from that and stick it into a sound program, or?
Well, there's
a
big.
Do you have a tracker?
I do have a tracker. I have Atlas DJ for my Game Boy. I wonder if I can turn it on here, if it won't be too loud. I just got my soundboard. Can you hear that? Yeah, so I do have a tracker. I use Atlas DJ on my Game Boy. Let's see if this plays. Nope. There it goes. Can you guys hear that?
Oh, we can hear that.
Oh, yes. Yeah, we can hear that.
Yeah, so then this is a cover of a Deadmau5 song, Strobe, that my friend and I did, Anova, on a Game Boy, and it's all a tracker, and it's playing right here, right live off my Game Boy. I'm totally amazed that I'm able to just turn that on and have you guys hear it. I've been working towards this for like a decade, getting my studio, like, everything plugged into the right place. But yeah, it's a combination of, I'm going to turn that off. I'll send you a link where you can download it. I have no idea how loud that was, so I'm sorry if I deafened you.
That's all right.
Now.
I'm sure it was a lot.
It was loud enough to hear, but we could still hear you over.
Yeah.
So that was good.
Yeah, that's the hard part. So yes, I have a tracker. The Game Boy is great, but what I really like to do is get it sounding good on the Game Boy and then either bring in a drum machine. Like I wonder if this will work. Yeah. So this is amazing. So bring in a drum machine.
To res that.
Yeah. So bring in a drum machine or bring it onto my computer and use some samples that I already have there. So the style that I mix is very varied. I worked in a recording studio for a few years before I started DJing. So my background is really more in engineering and getting the sound, getting stuff to sound, I don't want to say correct, but getting it to sound good to the human ear. So like the Game Boy, for example, it sounds really great, but there's like a little persistent fuzz that goes like at like 9,000 hertz. So I have to go in after I record the Game Boy. You don't hear it in a live setting, but when you record it onto computer, for some reason, all of a sudden that's there. So I have to go in and take a little equalizer and notch out that frequency and maybe cut off a little bit of the low end and then to limit it to make it sound loud, so when you play it out of your iTunes, it sounds like it would coming out of an analog board. And that's kind of the fun stuff. I like mastering and mixing music. And when I'm making music myself, it could be from a Game Boy, it could be from a drum machine, it could be from a sample of a piece of video game music that I just heard on YouTube, and I ripped the YouTube file, put it into Ableton Live, and threw some drums that I had just sitting on my hard drive on there. So I haven't totally mastered my own way of making music, but what I have found out is that I love mixing other people's music, which is the whole DJ Cutman experience. Live is the majority of the music is either from my label, from my friends on the internet, from my friends in Philadelphia, playing in and doing the necessary things so I can play a chiptune track right after a Skrillex track. Like, what kind of technical stuff do you need to be able to do to have those two pieces of music sound proper one after another and sound good coming out of a big stereo system? A Game Boy hardware by itself sounds good out of a big stereo system, but sometimes the recording doesn't either. So, yeah, I'm getting boring here. Sorry.
I had fond memories of hooking up my Game Boy just to my two-speaker.
Yeah, I used to put headphones on and just listen to the World 1-1 of Super Mario Land, just like, this is weird, but I guess this is why they gave you the headphone jack. I just listened to that little tune all day. Until I ran out of time and I was like, man, I really should have just waited by the flag.
And then Tetris and R-Type and...
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you refer to yourself as DJ Cutman. Is that your kind of inspiration for doing this kind of thing, actually the Mega Man series?
I love Mega Man. I'm learning now that there's a lot of people who never beat any of the Mega Man games. Learning most from convention. Yeah, there's a lot of people who just think that they're too hard and don't play them. But I always played them and beat them. Not the horrible Mega Man 1 port for the PC that happened. That was the first one I played, and that game is in like, there's actually a wall that I just never could jump past. And like, game, nope, sorry. That's what you get on that little diskette. But Cutman was actually a nickname I got in the recording studio by one of my clients who saw me cutting audio, like vocal takes by eye. So I'd be like, for example, like I did hip hop. So the track, the beat would start, and they'd be playing the beat. And then, of course, there's always like some amount of them drinking something. All right. I'm going to do this take. Give me more snare on my headphones. All right. So here comes the verse. 1, 2, 3. And then the verse would start. So we have all this garbage before. Not garbage. Yeah. Creative garbage. You know, stuff that you don't want in the track, or maybe you want it quieter. And so I was cutting the things out, and one of my clients was like sitting with me while I was doing it. And he just said the word cut man. He's like, hey, cut man, cut that stuff out. And I don't know, the name kind of stuck. And when I started making video game remixes, my process is very much drag a big old sample in, an entire song or an entire drum loop. And then rather than just building, my process is more to kind of throw in the key elements like the drums, the sample, and then cut stuff out. And by that, by taking things out, by cutting, I'm actually able to create new musical ideas and change subtle details to make like a DJ Cutman remix sound different from somebody else who may have had the same drums or the same sample. My whole process is based on removing key elements and moving things around rather than building. So, I don't know. The name just kind of stuck. It sounded like a DJ anyway, so.
Okay, has anyone got any other questions for this evening?
Well, I was just thinking, when it comes, you were saying that you were concentrating on NES and mm-hmm. Game Boy, that yes. kind of thing. Ever play around with MIDI sequencing or Amiga modules, or were those a bit new?
I have done some MIDI stuff. Actually, I've done quite a bit of MIDI stuff, none of which I am very good at releasing to people. I don't know why. Actually, no, that's not true. I have one album or an EP out called Chiptune Hero, which is a bunch of cover songs. They're Jackson 5, Owl City, Michael Jackson, lots of Jacksons. That's all done with MIDI and a free plugin called Magical 8-Bit by the Japanese band YMCK. So they released this free chiptune plugin.
I know them. Yeah.
Yeah. They're fantastic, and their plugin's really great too. So I made this tribute album, and it's all just it's just MIDI data being played back by this chiptune sound. So no hardware or anything like that. And I have a ton of original material that I've been doing with MIDI and chiptune plugins like Plog Chip Sounds, which is a very faithful emulator of the Nintendo, the Game Boy, the Amiga, the SID. It's got so many awesome chips, and I've just started playing around with that. You have a lot of flexibility when you don't use hardware, and I really like being able to try out all the different sounds and find what I want. But when it comes to just writing a song from scratch, man, writing with LSDJ on the Game Boy is just super fun. Like, if you had asked me, you know, would you write music if you it was more like playing Tetris? I'd be like, absolutely. I'm a big rock band nut, or I used to be a Guitar Hero nut, and all those Beat Mania, Dance Revolution. I attribute most of my DJing skill to playing every single Dance Revolution game that I could get on my bootleg PlayStation all throughout high school. That's really that hardcore timing conditioning that has done me well.
Okay.
But I mean, there's lots of chips, there's lots of sounds, and I'm still exploring and learning what sounds good.
They all have their own little characteristics.
Yes. Yeah. Exactly.
I find, being a massive nerd, I can just listen to a bit of music, and it can be from about, you know, 20, 25 years ago, and I can say, right, this is a Spectrum.
Yeah.
It's an AY.
I can name a Game Boy. I can name a DMG Game Boy or a Game Boy Color and a Nintendo chip. Some of the other ones, a SID chip, too, has a really awesome sound. But, I don't know. The chiptune, like I said, they don't sound like anything else, so it's pretty easy to pick out. And and just fun to listen to.
Okay. And there's always some that manage to blur the line. There are always some that you can manage to make a chip sound, you know, quite different from the norm. But other times, they've got their thumbprint all over.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. That's definitely a certain such chip.
We're running out of time for this evening, but I just wanted to ask, Chris, if you got an album coming out, well, we'll say tomorrow, but for you people listening, hopefully, it'll be out now as you listen. Have you not got an album coming out?
Yes, there's an album that is out now, listeners. It's called Triple Triad. We talked about card games very briefly earlier. It's called Triple Triad, and it's remixes from Final Fantasy VI, Final Fantasy VII, and Final Fantasy VIII. It is 12 tracks, and it's out right now at music.gamechops.com. It's great. It's by a UK producer, actually, by the name of Micah, and he is just fantastic. High-energy dance music based off of Final Fantasy. What's not to like? We have that in there, actually. Yeah, the fanfare.
Yeah. I have to.
All right, well, we'll be providing links to amazing stuff for this episode for the write-up, but like I said, it's unfortunately, it is all we've got time for this evening, for this week. And it's been such an amazing episode.
It has, yeah.
I'm really glad we've had you on the show, Chris.
I had a blast.
Your enthusiasm is catching, I think. Amazing.
Maybe you could come back again?
Maybe.
Yeah, totally.
People, just because we haven't said the address for it, but you should definitely check out Chris's podcast, which you can find at djcutman.podomatic.com. Serious, and we will be linking to it, but it's a lovely listen. I
was listening early.
definitely, I like the couple of times where I've just kind of put it on at work when I haven't had to talk to people, and it's just been nice.
I put it on at work actually, yeah. Too, whenever I listen to it. I'm probably my biggest listener of my own podcast. It's true. I like listen. The new episode comes out and I upload it and then listen to it continuously until it's time to do the next one. But I'm a weirdo.
All right. So it's goodbye from
Chris, Twitter at VideoGameDJ and GameChops.com.
And it's good night from me, Paul Wood. I'm Super Retroid on Twitter and Retroid on Eurogamer.net.
It's good night from me, Paul Blewett. I have a website, paul-blewett.com, and I'm on Twitter as Paul Blewett.
And it's good night from me, Emily King. You can find me on Twitter at EK6891. You could also maybe have a look at my website at drowninginmultimedia.co.uk. You can find Nerd Assemble over at www.nerdassemble.co.uk. We're also available on iTunes. You can find us on Twitter at Nerds Podcast. Plus, we're also lurking around Facebook and Google Plus under Nerd Assemble Podcast. We may have Pinterest. We may have good episodes, like a bazillion things that I created and never knew about. I don't know. But anyway, stuff. So, good night.
Good night.
Good night. Yeah.